This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. Today's episode is another installment of Make Remake. It's where we take a movie and see its remake and compare the two. Not to see which one is necessarily better or worse, but to see how two movies can tell the same story, both similarly and differently. In the past, we've paired such films as The Day the Earth Stood Still, Ikaru, Cape Fear, and more. On today's show, we are considering the 1953 film The Wages of Fear, directed by Henri-Georges Clouzot, and the 1977 remake Sorcerer, directed by William Friedkin. If you have not seen at least one version of the movie, be warned that there will be plenty of spoiler talk in this episode. Joining the show today to talk about the two films is Taylor Baker, who is one half of the podcast team behind the excellent show Drink in the Movies, and also writes reviews on the DITM website. This is the first time Taylor has been a guest on the podcast, so welcome, Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this discussion. And you just mentioned Cape Fear, which is a film very near to my heart, at least in the Robert De Niro version. And I can't help but see some similarities between the nihilism there and what we're going to talk about today.
You know what? I think I never even thought about that, but you're right. I will say I wasn't as high as on the Scorsese version, and I love the original. That was a bit of a shock for me.
Fun anecdote here. I think that's my absolute favorite Robert De Niro performance of all time. So that's where I stand.
It is a great performance. It is, yeah. So we've actually we've known each other for a couple years now, not super well, but like you're down based in Seattle and I'm up here in Vancouver, and usually we run into each other at the Vancouver International Film Festival. And it was this past year we got to spend quite a bit of time seeing several movies together. It was one of those things where it's like, man, I've not had Taylor Baker on the show. I really need to get Taylor on the show. So yes. I'm glad we finally were able to make it work.
And I'm glad that your recommendation of going to see The Teacher's Lounge paid off so well, and that I can now hold you in such high esteem, because, you know, that could have really, really compromised our friendship. But now I have you to owe for one of my top 10 films of the year, at least at the moment.
Excellent. I'm very happy to hear that. Well, sort of tangentially related to that, I'm actually going to use your guest appearance as an opportunity to announce a new venture that you and I are actually both a part of. Myself, alongside Matthew Simpson and Thomas Stoneham Judge, have just founded the Cascadia Film and Television Critics Association, which you are an inaugural member of as well. We represent the Cascadia region, which as of right now is British Columbia and Washington State.
Yes, very, very exciting. We're in the middle of some voting, and I think that you're hard at work on some different social media posts sharing what the inaugural award is going to be for the, what are we calling this award again? I'm
the
blurring
best
my
Cascadian word. Film.
Best Cascadian film. So, mm-hmm. I imagine by the time this is published, we may have all of the nominees announced.
Yes, we absolutely will. Yeah, there's going to be more talk about that at the end of the episode. But if you are interested in what we're talking about here, follow at Cascadia Critics on all social media, and you'll see that, or the website CascadiaCritics.com. But yeah, very, very exciting. And the next episode is actually going to have Matthew and Simon Best. So we're probably going to reveal some more stuff that we've been working on as well.
Fantastic. I hope you guys are talking about some sort of Godzilla or King Kong related title.
It is actually James Bond related.
Oh, okay. I could see them enjoying that as well. I could see them enjoying that as well. Fun teaser.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let us get to the show at hand.
Simple goutte de ce liquide. Quatre hommes ont joué leur vie au volant de ces camions. Ils atteindront les limites du danger, du courage et de la peur. Mario?
Chaud.
Monsieur Jean?
Et si les pics veulent me mettre ça sur le dos? C'est oui, not avec chance. Inzebaba.
Luigi?
Bimba.
The Wages of Fear was a French novel written by Georges Arnaud that came out in 1950. In the original 1953 film, Henri-Georges Clouzot, who later went on to direct Diabolique 2 years later, brought the story to life. The film is about Mario, a Frenchman played by Yves Montand, who is stuck in an unnamed South American country. The village is so remote and poor, there is barely enough money to pay for food. Effectively, both locals and visitors are stuck in a makeshift prison that has no walls, since no one can afford to ever leave. While showing us the village, we get introduced to other characters including Luigi, played by Folco Lulli, an Italian who has concrete dust in his lungs and causing him to slowly die, and rooming with Mario. Bimba, played by Peter Van Eck, is a German whose father was killed by the Nazis and was forced to work in the salt mines himself, and the mysterious Joe, played by Charles Van Al, a gangster who arrives via plane because he was running away from someone or something. Joe is a Frenchman who quickly bonds with Mario, causing a rift in the town of vagabonds and locals. The only source of income is an American-owned oil well that takes advantage of local labor by exploiting them. When a giant fire occurs at an oil well, it is decided that the only way to stop is to cap the well by an explosion using nitroglycerin. The job is deemed too dangerous for the union workers to do, so a high bounty is put up, with the company asking locals if they're willing to transport the extremely volatile substance hundreds of miles across the rough and dangerous terrain, where if the liquid is disturbed too much, it will blow the truck sky high. The four men are brought on to drive two trucks and face numerous obstacles along the way, with the audience knowing that at any moment, everything can go wrong. In 1977, William Friedkin, who 4 years earlier released the classic horror film The Exorcist in 1973 and 1971 won both Best Picture and Best Director for The French Connection, decided to remake the story, but to stay closer to the original novel instead of remaking the Clouseau film, which had differed from the novel in some aspects. Instead of just dropping us in the unnamed village, we get four prologues showing how Jackie, played by Roy Scheider, who now goes by the name Juan Dominguez, was a getaway driver for the Irish Mafia, and after robbing Italian gangsters in New Jersey, gets into an accident and as the only survivor flees the country since a hit has been put on his head. Victor, played by Bruno Kremer, is a French banker who is about to be indicted for fraud, and after his father-in-law refuses to bail him and his brother-in-law out, the brother-in-law kills himself. Realizing he has no options, he flees France. Qasem, played by Amidou, is a Palestinian terrorist who sets off a bomb in Jerusalem. He is the only member of his crew who is not killed or captured and flees the country. Lastly, Nilo, played by Francisco Rabel, is a Mexican hitman. We see him kill a man, and we don't see him again until he arrives via plane, just like Joe in the original film. When a bombing at an oil well causes a fire, dynamite explosion is the only way to stop it. The dynamite was stored incorrectly, causing nitroglycerin to leak, making the sticks very dangerous. The four are hired to drive two trucks and face similar obstacles in order to drive across the jungle. In Sorcerer, we learn that the unnamed South American country is actually Colombia. Before we get into the bulk of the show, I want to point out that this pairing was chosen by me because of William Friedkin's passing on August 7th this year. So I want to ask, what was your history with Friedkin's work, and have you seen either of the films that we were discussing today, Taylor?
I had seen Sorcerer previously many, many years ago, and despite having rated it positively on Letterboxd, apparently, had no warm feelings towards the film when I recalled it. And I was very excited by the pairing here, not just because I wanted to revisit the film, but also because I'd never seen a Henri Georges Clouseau film before. As far as my relationship with Friedkin, outside of Sorcerer, Friedkin is probably my favorite consistent director. Bug and Killer Joe are some of my favorite films this side of 2000. Hunted, the Tommy Lee Jones and Benicio del Toro film, is one of the most watched films that I would put on repeat growing up. So he's very near and dear to my heart. And, you know, his 12 Angry Men remake and his recent Caine Mutiny Court Martial remake are also very close to my heart. So very excited to have this excuse to revisit it and talk over it with you.
Amazing. I'm very happy to hear all of that. I had never seen either of the films, so both of these are new. I try with this Make Remake series to do movies that I hadn't seen, because that way I can sort of go into them with sort of a blank slate, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I was very excited to get into them. And the reason why, obviously, I chose it was because of Friedkin's passing this year. And I had only seen, I'd seen The French Connection a couple times, really like it. And I saw The Exorcist for the first time a couple years ago and loved it. And when he passed, I was like, man, I've not seen any other Friedkins. I need to watch more. And so I watched To Live and Die in L.A. and absolutely blew my mind. It was an instant five-star, you know, one of the best movies I've ever seen, and I've been sort of itching to get to more of his work ever since I watched that. And so I was very happy to get to Sorcerer, and interestingly enough, much like you, feel like it doesn't hold up as well compared to The Wages of Fear, which is a far superior film. But man, oh man, was freaking one hell of a director. Like there's just, you know, as a whole, the story, we're probably going to get into it, doesn't work as well, but the shots that he's managed to make in this film were just so incredible. And I was like, it's such a loss, and I cannot wait to watch more of his work. And so hearing you say all these amazing things about other movies, some of them were on my watch list, stuff like Bug and Killer Joe, and then other ones that I'm not as familiar with, definitely are going to move to the top of my watch list now.
Yeah, I mean, if you need another remake plug, you know, do 12 Angry Men sometime. Watching the Lumet version against the Friedkin version would sure be something. And you could do a similar thing with the King Mutiny Court Martial. You'd have a couple different choices there. So if I can make one further recommendation, definitely do Bug and Killer Joe. Tracy Letts, who we all probably know as an actor more than a screenwriter here. He wrote the stage plays that those films are based on. And I think that they're featuring some of the best direction and some of the best performance work that you'll see since the 2000s. Personal perspective, obviously.
Fantastic. I love these recommendations, so I'm very happy you're saying that, and I will take note of that. All right. Let's get into this. We were talking a bit before that we feel like there's going to be a lot less similarities than there are differences, because the films, you know, differ quite a lot, which is quite surprising considering, you know, on the surface, they are very similar. Like, there's some remakes where you're like, man, they're not even, you know, playing the same sport, basically. At least here, you'd be like, oh yeah, four guys are hired. They have to transport a dangerous substance across the jungle. Boom. That's the quite literally boom.
Yes.
Unintended. But yeah, you know, once you kind of realize watching it and getting deeper into it, these movies aren't that similar. So it was a little tricky coming up with some similarities. So I feel like we were talking about how this section, the first half, is probably going to be a little shorter than the second half of the episode. But I'll start things off where I think the main thing that happens in these movies is there are three main obstacles that the drivers must face on their journey after they've been hired. So basically, as I said, the way it works is four men are hired to drive two trucks. That way they can sort of alternate between who's driving and who is resting, I guess, is the idea, and they can easily do it, and they each have to carry their truckloads across the jungle. In Wages, the trucks must drive on a stretch of road made of corrugated metal that will vibrate the truck if they don't maintain a certain speed, which has to be like a inspiration for the movie Speed, it feels like.
At some level, perhaps. I hadn't even thought about that. Good point. It's about 40 miles an hour that they're supposed to reach.
Yes. And then they have to do a tight turn around a bend and then drive on an incomplete bridge that is rotting. And then lastly, they must blow up a giant rock blocking the road. In Sorcerer, they also have to turn a tight corner. Then they have to cross a dilapidated bridge over a river. And finally, they must blow up a large tree blocking the road. So obviously, some of the obstacles differ slightly, but I think both movies sort of, you know, deal with, it's not a comedy, but it's the rule of three of, they have three main obstacles that they sort of must traverse in order to get to their destination. Both sort of sets of drivers also feature another final obstacle, which maybe we'll get into a little bit later, that definitely is getting into spoiler territory. But more or less, would you agree that there are sort of the three main obstacles that they have to deal with in both films?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is clearly, you know, what they're both pulling from the original text here. And then they're just riffing on the ways that they want to encounter, you know, what is maybe the will of God or the acts of fate. You know, I think that each director viewed who was operating behind the scenes here to make life such a living hell for these men differently, but that, you know, whether it's God or fate or faith, the three that you've selected are direct metaphors that they've taken from the novel and twisted to their own location settings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great interpretation of the way they've decided to set these up. And
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it. I'm just like, man, Wages of Fear did this so much better than Sorcerer, which is a shame because like we're talking about how much we really appreciate Friedkin's work. And I just sort of feel that Clouzot spends way more time building up the tension than Friedkin does. And it's really to the detriment of the film, because while watching The Wages of Fear, I can't count the amount of times that I know this, none of this is real. This is a movie. This is all fake. But the amount of times that I would be like gasping, being like, ooh, you gotta be careful. Ooh, that wood is rotting, or like shouting at my TV in agony because of how nervous The Wages of Fear made me as they were going through the different obstacles. And that is such a rare recurrence. I usually never do anything like that.
I love that. So I wasn't orating at my TV at all, but I certainly was gripping my fingers into my armchair and, you know, curling my toes in certain sequences where, you know, Clouzot, he is using the close-up cutting that I particularly love from Sergio Leone. And I always view those really frenetic cuts of close-up things to build tension as a Leone thing. But I believe that he's working far before Leone had become famous for his work. So he's really doing these fast edit cuts of close-ups showing you like the speedometer going over this corrugated metal thing. And you're just, you know, at the edge of your seat wondering whether or not they're going to be able to speed up to 8 miles per hour. And if they're going to be able to slow down to 36 miles per hour so that neither truck blows up and they don't hit each other and all die. And that's just, you know, that's the magic of movies. If ever I've seen it this week.
Yeah. Because it's the combination of the shot selection with the editing timed at just the right moments, because you could very easily insert a whole bunch of edits being back and forth, being like, oh, we're building tension through quick edits. But he really knew when to hold the shots and what to hold the shots of and when he needed to do the edit to sort of maximize the tension, which is a real skill of mastery. It's one of those things where you don't appreciate great editing until you see it and you're like, ah, this is what it is.
Yes. And it's also the humility to have such an excellent long shot, which he clearly did on the corrugated roadway, and then just cut in the middle of it multiple times to get those faces, those eyes darting down at the odometer, the close-up of the odometer, going back to the eyes, and then going back to the long shot that's clearly just a continuation that we broke from. Very enamored by The Wages of Fear here. And it's interesting to see the moments that I do feel like it did come through in Sorcerer. I actually feel like Friedkin got away from his own bag of tricks and was kind of double dipping, trying to get into Clouzot's bag of tricks, because near the end, there are sequences where we are doing these close-up cuts to the odometer and then to the eyes of Scheider. So what was your perspective?
Yeah, I think for the most part, for me, it was just, there was a lack of tension in Sorcerer for the most part that I really was missing. And, you know, maybe it has to be the fact that Wages of Fear might be one of the most intense films that I've ever watched. And then you go to Sorcerer, and maybe if I watched it, you know, years apart, that I'd be able to appreciate it a bit more. But it was just one of those things where I watched and I was just like, all the tension feels sucked out because the shot selection mixed with the editing just didn't stack up. And I point specifically to the river crossing sequence. So obviously that's the main difference in the three obstacles that Wages of Fear does not have.
You feel the same way about it that I do. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I was hoping I was the only one that didn't actually find that very enamoring.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the main, I guess the centerpiece of Sorcerer is that there's this very dilapidated bridge that they have to cross, and it's going over this, you know, fast moving river that sort of feels like it's supposed to be a hurricane, that sort of feel. And as the truck is driving, the wood is collapsing and there's someone kind of leading the way. And it's a very, very impressive setup. And the fact that they actually did it, and I was reading about, and that this very dilapidated bridge was actually a very technical thing that they built. It cost $1 million in 1977 dollars, which is very impressive. And you watch it, and I just had none of the tension, which is really unfortunate.
Yes. There's a moment where a tree pushes up against the truck and the men. And that is the most effective that it became, because that's where it became the most overt. The Earth is like the sorcerer right now. Like it is the evil wizard attacking you, and you can visually see it. And that was cool. But broadly, while impressive and expensive and all that stuff is, it didn't, to me, this is just my perspective, look good. I was not convinced by what had led up to me that this mattered. And I was not buying in to what the film was presenting to me and asking me to take on faith there. And the water, the rain hitting the men was not convincing, right? That's, I know that we're trying to stay in similarities here, but when I go look at the stylings of the Clouseau film against this, and I look at how he's drenching the men there versus here, it's just so much more effective because of what he's doing with his frame. He's very purposeful. And here, the way that they're shooting, it's very documentary based. And so the style of what is being shot is not conveying how wet and torrential it is, which is a pity because it clearly was. And if it was more effective visually, then it would have really taken me as an audience member by the nose and come with the journey a lot more.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, I want to move into a different similarity. And in both films, a major plot point is how an American oil company is taking advantage of the locals. The well is owned and operated by Americans, but they use local labor for more dangerous jobs. An explosion at one of the wells causes over a dozen locals to die, causing a small riot. Mm-hmm. Things are gone even further in Sorcerer, where the explosion was the cause of a terrorist attack, where the oil company does not want to get the government involved to upset the powers that be. So this was, you know, very much a an indictment of American imperialism, not quite colonialism because they've not colonized the South American country, but very much an indictment on American exceptionalism of what was going on. And it was interesting reading about, you know, behind the scenes stuff of The Wages of Fear, where it was a not a protest film, but I think it was banned for a while because it was deemed un-American because of how critical it is. Mm-hmm. And you look at this plot point and you're just like, this is absolutely what's going on all over the world, where, you know, you can point to things like the Iraq War existed just because, you know, the U.S. wanted oil and things like that. So I like that both films point out how the American influence in South America sort of rules the way of the land.
Yes, these are both very clearly post-war films, and what they're reacting to is different eras of that war, right? So in The Wages of Fear, we're very much, you know, only a decade removed, I think, at release, and which means it would have been shooting under a decade being removed from the events of World War II. And, you know, the author of the novel that both these films is based on, he was in prison for in waiting for a trial during World War II in France, in which his father and his housekeeper had been murdered, and he was the only person they could finger. So they put him in prison for 3 years while he waited a trial, basically is the story. And that kind of led to him doing this work and some other work. And so the novel obviously has its own things to say about World War II, but I think both of these films do. And sure, they're using American oil here, but I think that the iconography is very interesting, particularly in Sorcerer. At near the end, we see a banner that is constructed in such a way that everything except for the eagle, I believe, is see-through, so that it just really looks like the Nazi eagle iconography.
The same thing, yeah. Yeah.
And so I think it's a direct criticism of, the foreign policy and the behavior and, you know, correlating the two. I don't know that I have much more to say than that there's a deep thematic similarity here, and I haven't fully interrogated it. And I honestly think I need to read the book to fully understand the triangulation of what's happening in both these films and what the original text said.
Yes, I would imagine the book probably deals with it a lot more than either movie does, as far as I feel like this idea of American foreign policy is probably the heart of what the entire story is actually about, if I was to wager a guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know for Friedkin, he envisioned the story as a Cold War allegory, in particular, and that the truck drivers were in some way like everybody, you know, agreeing to carry these nuclear bombs, and you either have to work together or you're all going to die, which I thought was a very interesting thing to put into his text. And, you know, he's obviously passed, but since he made the film, he's mentioned that he's changed his perspective, but that when he was making this film, that he had a keen sense of dread, and that it was directly a Cold War film. And obviously the Cold War is directly associated to World War II. So to me, these are distinctly post-war films.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, because I can totally see where he's getting that idea from, and the fact that they have to work together. But the two trucks are also very separate. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Major, Russia major and America.
Major spoiler alert, where one of the trucks does end up exploding and killing two of the men in both films. That is a mm-hmm. plot point that is carried over in both. But it's not like... Because I feel like the Cold War analogy being... I guess... I'm trying to put my words into a cohesive thought here. The idea of the Cold War fears of being like, oh, if one country sets off nuclear weapons, the other will retaliate right away and they will both be dead. Whereas in this, the trucks, they don't actually work together in that same sense, where one even blows up and it does not affect the other one, other than, you know, mentally it is a very anguishing moment for them to go through to witness that. It's sort of a very interesting maybe subplot where I can see where Friedkin is going, but I don't think that it fully matches up one to one.
So I'm with you. And so, yes. And I actually think that, The Wages of Fear does that particular idea better because of the relationship that those trucks have with each other versus the relationship the trucks have here. To me, those trucks and truck drivers really were part of a team, and they were relying on each other, and they were exchanging who was first and who was second constantly along the way. And that was a lot more of a cohesive perspective for me. Whereas here, it never feels like the trucks are on the same mission.
Yes.
Even though they definitely
and
are.
And even so in Wages of Fear, they would do things like leave notes for each other, messages about hazards and obstacles that they might encounter.
Yes. Which, tell me if I'm getting off track here, but to me, the place and location in Wages is an actual character. And here in Sorcerer, Friedkin is just using it as an element of destruction and nihilism. And the ways that the characters are interacting in The Wages of Fear, like you mentioned, leaving that note, then having someone who's at that gas station pick up the handkerchief and kind of wave it, you know, they're using secondary elements of the area, which are literal people that live there, to bring this environment to life. And that nothing like that ever occurs in Sorcerer. They're really a stranger in a strange land the entire time. And it's really just them against fate.
Yeah, I think that's a great perspective on it. Yeah. Do you have any other similarities you want to get into, or should we?
I think the similarities I have will be best suited for differences. I think we'll come to them together. I as I've told you before, I've got quite a lot here, and I'm fascinated by some of the extra textual stuff and some of the actual textual stuff that's happening in these films.
All right.
Four men condemned by their past, robbed of their future, trapped in a life that was also a death. Four men take an incredible chance, face an impossible challenge, and risk the only thing they have left to lose.
So So I think the first difference that I want to sort of start off is how we're introduced to the four men are very different. In The Wages of Fear, we're dropped into this unnamed South American village where slowly we get introduced to Mario, Joe, Bamba, and Luigi. Other than Joe, who we see arriving into the area, the rest of the men's backstory isn't told right away. It sort of comes in bits and pieces. In Sorcerer, we get four prologues where we get to see how each man ended up in Colombia. Nilo is a hitman who kills someone in Mexico. Kasim is a Palestinian militant who sets off a bomb in Jerusalem. Victor is a banker who's about to be indicted on fraud. And Jackie holds up a church that is collecting money on behalf of the mafia. All four men are on the run and in hiding before they even meet up. And we know all of their backstory. And so as the characters meet each other, we know all this information, whereas it's sort of unveiled at a much slower rate in The Wages of Fear in a way that, like, oh, I'm meeting you for the first time. I'm not going to know everything about you. I'm going to slowly learn this information as we go on this journey together, which I thought was a very different way. And it's so funny. I was watching Sorcerer and I messaged you and I was like, hey, this intro is very different than The Wages of Fear, which I thought was pretty funny. What did you think in the way that we're introduced to these characters and given their backstories?
So, there's quite a lot couched within this, right? Which first and foremost, I am most comfortable as a viewer and a story interpreter with the way that The Wages of Fear operates. I like to arrive into a place and learn that world with a character and have that character kind of present the world to me. And what Friedkin does is he says, I don't care what you like. I don't care who you are. You're going to do things my way and it's going to be abrasive. And you're not really going to know what the hell you're looking at until halfway through the movie when I make it clear to you what all this means. And so for me, I vastly prefer The Wages of Fear because we're so used to having a story told to us in that manner that it's easy to interpret, even though it's a foreign language film. Whereas despite largely being in English, Sorcerer is actually, you know, very hard to reach because you never really know what Friedkin is wanting to present this as. It's not fitting within our normal narrative framework. It's really spending half of a film building up the backstories of characters without telling you why you need to know the backstories. Now, because we'd watched Wages of Fear before, we know what it's getting to, but that didn't, for me at least, make it any more easy to sit through these backstories and try to care. And that's not that I didn't appreciate the filmmaking or the explosiveness or the presentation. It's just the way that he was doing characterization within the film, which was passively and through the moving image, was very unmoving to me. I never felt anything for these people. I was just impressed by the technical audacity of what was happening.
Yeah, it's so interesting because The Wages of Fear is a longer film. It's 2 hours and 11 minutes, where Sorcerer is 2 hours and 1 minute. And we spend so much time on this prologue in Sorcerer, it really does take up almost a third of the film before we even get to Colombia. Mm-hmm. Where and so that's why we're talking about, you know, the first similarity of being the three main obstacles that they must overcome while they're driving. And it seems so short. And the reason was, both the movie is shorter and we spend so much time on their backstories that there's a lot less time devoted to the actual journey that these truck drivers have to go on. Whereas Wages of Fear, yes, we do get quite a bit of an extended sequence before they start driving, but it really is setting the tone and what the life is like in this village. We never really, I feel like we never truly get to feel what it's like living in this village where there's no money for anything and you are effectively stuck there because you cannot afford to get out, where The Wages of Fear really does that incredibly. I will say in Sorcerer, the prologues were incredible to watch, especially the Roy Scheider bank robbery scene and the car crash that they have. Phenomenal action work. It was funny. I was watching it. I was like, this kind of feels like a Michael Mann film. And then I realized afterwards that the score was done by Tangerine Dream.
Yeah,
who did the score for Thief. And I was like, that's why it feels like a Michael Mann film.
Yep, I've got the same note here. I've got the same exact note. And that's actually, that's the one place that I think Sorcerer is better than Wages, is in its, you know, what it's doing with sound here. I do think that what it's doing with musicality in the course of the film is just fantastic, and Tangerine Dream, more than Friedkin, probably deserves the credit for that. And also, I do want to go rewatch Thief now.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed the prologues, but it wasn't for this movie. If it was for a different movie that they're telling a different story, I think it would have been great. I really liked the way they set these characters up. It was all very interesting. It just unfortunately cut down what we needed from this movie to tell this story, and it was not for the betterment.
Yeah, I hesitate to agree. I think that I absolutely agree with the perspective that you have here, but maybe if you just do the prologue and then you show them arrive in Colombia and begin their life there, and then you go do the next one. It's just the way that he did these four, just smash cutting them kind of at the end, where you go to the next one and you go to the next one and you go to the next one. It doesn't provide any satisfaction or throughput to the audience member of why we're going through this. And Friedkin clearly, you know, loves saying fuck you to the audience. But yes. As an audience member, was just like, give me a reason to buy in, right? And, you know, to Friedkin's credit, I mentioned to you before we started recording that I was listening to an interview with him and Nicholas Vinding Refn. And in that interview, he says very overtly, when they're talking about Sorcerer, I don't believe in heroes, period, flat. And I'll be gosh darned if this film isn't proof that he absolutely does not believe in heroes. And so, you know, part of what my hesitations are mean that what he was meaning to do in making villains and anti-heroes was very effective.
Yes.
Right. Because I think that The Wages of Fear does make me want to side with these not good people quite effectively.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. There's a lot less redeeming aspects to any of the characters in Sorcerer, which, you know, as an audience member, we're said this is the main character, we're automatically going to want to sympathize with their plight, regardless if they're a good or a bad person. That's just sort of the nature of, oh, we're seeing the story. This is who we're rooting for. And yeah, I just, you never feel any sort of sympathy for any of the Sorcerer's characters, whereas The Wages of Fear, you actually do, and you understand the struggle that they're going and the dynamics that they have, and you sort of begrudgingly respect them, and you see how they start to work together as a team, and you're like, okay, you know what? If they can put their differences aside, I can put aside that they're not probably good people, but I can still root for them in the end.
Exactly. And I'm totally with you. Mm-hmm. Another difference here, and on the topic of Michael Mann, as well, that sequence where in Sorcerer, where the four men rebuild their trucks, I think that is where I was the most enamored. Obviously, the Tangerine Dream score was super helpful. Seems like it directly influenced Michael Mann in Thief to some extent. But that sequence, as far as visuals go, and what it does for the film actually was more convincing than the sequence where they work on the trucks and The Wages of Fear for me. How about you?
I agree. And that was the exact sequence that was like, this really feels like a Michael Mann film. So I'm glad we're on the same page for that, where it's like, this feels like the exact thing out of Thief, which is very interesting. But yeah, that was a very interesting difference, because in The Wages of Fear, you know, we're told that these truck drivers are getting top of the line, brand new trucks. Yes, they don't have specific suspensions that will help them carrying this delicate cargo, but they are brand new trucks and they should have no difficulties with any of them. Whereas in Sorcerer, they're like, hey, we're in the middle of nowhere. We have nothing. You can look at our scrapyard and you can take whatever truck you want and do what you need to do, but good luck.
Yes. And it's really fun to watch, you know, those close-ups of them working on whatever they're working on with the engines and, you know, bolting new things to the vehicle that are slightly better than the one that they took off. It's fun to watch and look at. It kind of feels like it's the beginning of an action scene. And, yes, you know, that is very much to my sensibilities.
It feels like that sequence was probably Friedkin's best use of mimicking the use of close-ups that Clouzot used in Wages of Fear, obviously for very different purposes and effects, but the effectiveness was probably at its best in that sequence.
Completely agree. Great point. And to slightly pivot here, one thing that is underlying a lot of my appreciation of Wages of Fear and my lack of enjoying Sorcerer to such a great extent when compared to Wages of Fear is that Clouzot's film is a lot more romantic. And my point here to underlie all points is he rewrote the story specifically to add the character Linda, who I've mentioned to you via email, who is played by his wife, just so he could have his wife with him during the shooting of the film. And if that doesn't tell you like the imperative differences between these two filmmakers, and one being a romantic and one being, you know, someone who does not believe in heroism, I don't know what will.
I think, interestingly enough, extratextually, the closest analogy to that is Roy Scheider wanted to be with his wife while filming, and his wife is an editor, and was like, hey, Friedkin, my wife's an editor. Can she come down and work on the film? And he was like, yeah, why not? She could be an associate editor on the film. And so they got to spend time together. So it's very interesting that there is an aspect that is similar to that. It's just not from the director's perspective.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. So building on that, Roy's role was originally supposed to go to Steve McQueen. And Steve asked for three different things so that he could bring his wife, Ally McGraw, with him. And Friedkin said no to every single one of them. And it's funny that he said yes to Roy. I had no idea. Yeah. That's quite humorous. But Linda, what did you make of her character? Because I think that she brings a lot in the first quarter of Wages of Fear, and I found that the longer the film went on, the more grating and like undermining perhaps to the narrative she became a little bit like a toy to the plot, and she was really just kind of overacting in some elements.
I agree with that, where I thought it was an interesting sort of setup where it sort of gives a new dynamic to this character, but the longer it sort of went on, it just sort of felt a bit like a shoehorn love subplot that, you know, you're like, oh, it's a big Hollywood movie. Obviously it's not a Hollywood film, but this idea of like, oh, it's a big Hollywood film, we got to have some sort of a romance storyline to it. Let's like, it's a story of just guys. We got to have a woman in there somewhere. So that way we can get the women in the audience sort of thing. And that's what it sort of felt a little shoehorned to me, especially as it went on, because I agree. I thought the setup was very interesting, especially where we get this dynamic where Joe is wanting Mario's attention, and Mario isn't sure if he wants to be hanging around Joe, who is new and interesting, or, you know, have his dates with Linda. So I thought that was a very interesting thing, but I agree, as it went on, it definitely worked less and less.
I'm glad I'm not alone. But I really did appreciate her in the first quarter of the film. I thought she really brought that town to life and made the bar feel like a distinct place that is really, really rare in filmmaking, like to know who's in there, why they're there, and what type of a place it is just because of their presence. And I thought that was really effective, and that he did a great job setting it up. It's just he couldn't sustain what he had done, and she turned into just this little dog or toy, essentially, that was just chasing her love interest throughout the whole film. Pointlessly, quite pointlessly. I was never really convinced of their romantic relationship. It was really just what she was doing for the place and setting the time.
Yeah,
that was impressive.
It's sort of also interesting because in Sorcerer there is a similar character, but we basically don't know anything about her. But both of Linda and this other woman, I don't know what her name was, I don't think it's ever revealed, work as washing the floors in this bar, and that seems to be their only real occupation is floor washer. And we see this one woman in the background of the bar scenes every time they're in this bar in the village. And at the very end, when Roy Scheider returns, he has a dance with her, which felt very out of place, where I was like, we were never introduced to this woman. We have no idea who she is, what's going on there. And yet we still have this one sequence. And I wonder if that's Friedkin wanting to, you know, include something that was maybe in the book, but maybe not necessarily, he couldn't figure out how to incorporate it, or wanting to incorporate more aspects from the Wages of Fear into Sorcerer. I'm not totally sure. Did that character do anything for you as well?
So that character in particular in Sorcerer did very, very little. And I viewed her more as the secondary character in the bar that is actually doing work besides scrubbing the floor than Linda from Wages of Fear. But as far as the ending, I viewed that more as Roy's character like coming to terms with the fact that he is about to die and wanting to have a dance at the last chance that he's going to have, because he can't cash that check. And yeah, he's handed an envelope that should have been sent weeks ago by this person who's clearly a liar. And that person tells him, don't worry about the check. We're going to take you to go cash it. And then as the film ends, a man gets out of a cab and walks in while he's there. And you hear what distinctly sounds like a gunshot. And, you know, not to ruin it for everybody, but, you know, in Friedkin's perspective, nobody leaves the film alive. So I think that, to me, it was just rather overtly, you know, he knew as soon as he got the envelope and the check, which are just meaningless pieces of paper that, you know, are promises that are definitely going to be broken by this guy and this company, that, you know, he's about to die and, you know, he's reached the end of his prison sentence.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a little bit nihilistic interpretation for you.
it absolutely is. Another, you know, minor difference where it's not as important to the plot, or at least the interpretation of it, but the cargo trucks carry vastly different loads. In Wages of Fear, the two trucks must carry full loads of nitroglycerin in jerry cans across the jungle without agitation. So literally their entire trucks are filled with these cans of this very dangerous liquid. Whereas in Sorcerer, the trucks each carry three boxes of dynamite. The dynamite was improperly stored, causing nitroglycerin to leak from the sticks, making transportation of them volatile. The three boxes each sit in trucks with sand surrounding them to avoid jostling. So it's very interesting how in Wages we get these very full loads of trucks, and in Sorcerer it's just three boxes, which is a bit of a funny, you know, visual, where it's a little bit more effective in Wages of Fear. It was like, look at, they have a giant bomb strapped to them. Whereas in Sorcerer, just like, it's just three boxes.
Yeah, for me it was way more effective in Wages, but like that's because of what I enjoy, right? I like the suspense and the trepidation visually by looking at each of these cans, and each one of them could do that. And I do appreciate the futility and like almost hamminess of like, look at these three wooden boxes, each one can like destroy everybody. Isn't that silly, right? It's kind of like when Roy is carrying the box, like, and he's ready to pass out at the end, right? And he's clearly just like stumbling. And it's not a smooth ride at all, but somehow the box isn't exploding. Like there's a futility that is funny there in that presentation. That's just not something that I personally appreciate to the level of artistry that I found in Wages.
Yeah, it did seem a little silly. It was just something I wanted to point out, where I was just watching. I was like, oh, it's just three boxes in each truck. Okay. I understand that it's very dangerous and can kill them all very easily, just the same as the truck full of nitroglycerin, but it's just a little funny as a visual.
Yeah, it's visually funny, and it does have consequential changes to how seriously I take the events, where they have to use an explosive to blow up what's blocking their path, right? In Wages, it's a large rock, and in Sorcerer, it's a large tree. And I found the blowing up of the large rock far more convincing and moving. I was so gripped by that scene, and I was so uninterested, but still like I was paying attention, but I didn't really care. I wasn't, you know, at the edge of my seat wondering if someone's going to die or not. I just had a very different relationship. And, you know, watching them carry that wooden box up to the tree, take it out, and then poke a hole in it after they sharpen a stick was so much less engaging than watching him siphon the nitroglycerin out of the can, and then into the canteen or the thermos that he had, and then using the rod to break through the rock and then filling it up and setting the complex trap and lighting the fuse. Like, that was just so much more riveting. And the way that they had to move the trucks as that was being set up, so much more convincing to me as an audience member of the stakes that are at place here and or at play here, and so much more effective in controlling the audience and our breath and just waiting for what's going to happen than what happened in Sorcerer with the tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that the rock sequence in Wages of Fear was probably one of the highlights for me as far as the building of the tension. I thought it was probably the most interesting of the three obstacles that they had to face. And probably one of the times I was, you know, most yelling at my TV. Anytime I've never done it myself, but anytime you see in film or whatever, someone, you know, siphoning gas from a car, I always get this visceral reaction of like, oh, that must taste disgusting. Because, you know, when you're filling up your car at a gas station, you could smell it and it gets in your body. And you're just like, this is disgusting. And you see someone doing it and I can't help but like retch a little bit. Mm. And then knowing that it's this, you know, extremely dangerous product where a single, you know, eyedropper worth of fluid can cause an explosion, and he's putting it in his mouth basically. It was a very visceral reaction to me where I'm just like, oh God, please don't die from trying to siphon the liquid.
Yes. And then, I mean, you're watching the rocks fall from the sky, right? And, oh, and yeah, you're just at gripping your armchair if you're me. And then, you know, that final rock is rolling down the hill and you don't know if it's going to hit the canister that they'd siphoned out of that was outside of the truck. And it's just, oh, yeah. It was so rich and engaging. I really, really loved that scene. And I, you know, the teamwork that was present there in Wages doesn't show up at all when they're moving the trucks here. Like, it's just the way that these characters are interacting with Sorcerer is so far away from the teamwork that we see in Wages that, you never really are with anyone. You're just kind of witnessing what's happening, for me, from a very like restrained documentary perspective is what I was reminded of. And so I never found myself on anyone's side or concerned about anyone's health or well-being. It was just like witnessing death sentences in retrospect. Yes. and how they're being carried out.
Yeah. Which is why I find it so funny that, you know, you're noting how in Sorcerer Friedkin was saying it was more of a Cold War sort of thing, and I feel like it works so much more with Wages of Fear, where it's like, it was before obviously the Cold War had really ramped up. It was similar era, early 50s, that it had started, but nowhere near to the extent that it would get in the 70s. So it's just so fascinating how you have these groups of people who clearly do not all like each other and they do not get along, but they realize if they want to get out of this alive, they have to put their differences aside and they have to work together. And it is so apparent in these sequences.
Yes, exactly. And what's interesting to me here is within the Wages of Fear, the way that explosives are used, they cause, at least in this rock sequence, right, they cause the environment to become dangerous in a very interesting way. But the fire sequences, while impressive for the time, never come close to touching what Friedkin's able to do here with his explosives and his fire. Whether you're looking at the end of the film at the oil well that's caught on fire, you're looking at the explosion of the tree, or you're back at the beginning during, you know, the terrorist attack in Jerusalem, like, all of these explosive sequences are still today, almost 50 years later, some of the most impressive explosives I've seen in cinema. And it's interesting how frenetic and excellent these visual effects are and how absent of emotion they end up being, where something small like you know, rocks rolling down a hillside within the wages of fear carries so much more impact to me as an audience member and paying attention.
Yeah, this was that final sequence in Wages was before one of the trucks had blown up. And I, going into this movie, I imagined, I was like, all right, well, one of them is not going to make it. One of the trucks or some of the men are not going to make it. And it was that sequence in particular of the rock rolling down the hill next to, and almost hits the jerry can that is right next to Joe, I believe it is. I was like, okay, this is the scene where one of them is going to die because the rock is going to hit it. They've set it up that they have to watch out for falling rocks. And Joe is so exhausted and not with what is going on that he is going to be the one that is unfortunately going to be the casualty in this scene. And I thought for sure he was going to die. And so I sort of appreciate that Clouseau is able to really make the audience think something is going to happen. And when it didn't happen, when it stops, you know, just centimeters short of hitting this can and what we know is going to happen if it hits it, it was a deep sigh of relief. I was like, oh, okay, he didn't end up dying. And so that way, when the explosion does happen, you know, a few minutes later where one of the trucks does blow up, it was way more impactful because I was like, oh, he really does go through and kill one team.
So I'm with you on half of that. But for me, I was still like, did Luigi die? And so when that rock was rolling down the hill, I was like, if it doesn't hit the jerry can, which is great, that's exactly what those are called, thank you for reminding me, then Luigi must be dead. And if it does hit the jerry can, then Luigi must be alive. And so when it doesn't, I had committed in my head that, oh no, Luigi died, my favorite character, no.
You are right, and as you say that, it reminded me of my thought process while I was watching it, because I did have a very similar thought process.
Good. I'm glad that we were both nervous for the correct character there, because he runs back to try to blow the fuse out, and I was like, no, the hero, the only good guy here who has concrete in his lungs and makes a really good pasta.
Yeah. Learning that he had concrete in his lungs was very much like, oh, this character is definitely not surviving this.
No.
It's already being set up that he has a life expectancy already, and Clouseau is not going to let him see that end.
Exactly. Are we able to talk about the final sequence here in both of the films where our human leads make a choice that causes someone else to leave the story?
Yes, please set it up.
Sure. So my preferred one obviously is going to be Wages of Fear here, where the two men die and the lead truck, one is Luigi and I forget the other one's name, he I believe was the Frenchman. And when the truck blows up, it bursts the pipeline that they've been driving alongside, because this road spans the pipeline from the town that they started in to the well. And it causes oil to begin to pool in the road that they have to go through. And Joe is in the oil pool with a stick trying to find where the bottom is so that who is our lead character's name?
It is Mario.
Mario. So that Mario can drive the truck through. And because it's oil, the tires will not be able to grip successfully. This has already been established a few times within the film so far that when it gets on mud or it is stuck in the middle of some trees, that it can't get a grip. And so this is very effective storytelling that is being performed here, because we know that if it does get stuck, there's no one else to help anymore. We're at the end of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And so as they start creeping through, Joe tells Mario that he cannot slow down or else the truck will be stuck within the oil pool. And then Joe trips and falls and he gets stuck under a tree, and Mario can't slow down, because if he does, then the truck's going to be stuck there forever. And so we watch him run over Joe, and it causes Joe to have a crushed leg from what can be told within the visuals of the film. We never really see his leg, but we do see that his foot is completely sideways, and that inside of his pants, there doesn't really seem to be what would be a normal leg there. And then they proceed to drive after he makes it out of the oil pool, and he gets Joe into the truck. They proceed to drive, and Joe is clearly losing consciousness from the injury. It's not clear if he's bleeding or not from the internal injury, or if there's just sepsis and shock happening, or what exactly occurs, but it does lead to his death. And so we watch our lead character in Wages, who kind of feels like a hero within the romanticism of the film, kill the person that gave him the job, kind of, and forced him to do it. So it's a very stirring moral event within the film for me. I'm still ruminating on it as I am the rock explosion. Hopefully I did okay there. What did I miss?
No, I think that's all very accurate. I think the one thing to sort of point out is that Mario and Joe sort of have a father-son relationship aspect. So that's what makes it all the more tragic, is that he sort of essentially has to run over his own father figure in order to save himself.
Yes. And that I should also mention, Joe throughout the film has been manifesting and kind of hiding that he's shell-shocked from what ostensibly is either World War II or some sort of a war that has happened, or an event that he was part of. And so when moments of high octane explosivity or life risking maneuvers are required from the truck, he gets out and runs away because of his fear from something that he's experienced in the past. And the way that that gets built up, it really does feel a little bit like it feels like an even deeper portrayal because of the way that that's been built up when Mario runs him over. And yes, it also feels inevitable.
And then on the flip side, yes. And then also on the flip side of Sorcerer, how the same two characters meet their end are very different, because they come across when the first truck explodes, a group of Colombian rebels show up and start, you know, digging through the wreckage. And when the second truck shows up, they try to hold them up and steal whatever they have. And from there, the Nilo character basically shoots some of the rebels, but gets shot himself. So that is how he ends up dying. He doesn't get run over. He gets shot.
Yes. And the within the Wages of Fear, Joe and Mario, they have this long conversation about life. And, there's kind of some camaraderie at the end, and a reparation of the relationship that seems like it was shattered when he ran him over. And that's largely missing here in Sorcerer. There's no happy endings in Sorcerer. It's all just quick pain and death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. It works far more effectively in Sorcerer, which I think now, as most people will have note, does this story in a much superior way in basically every single aspect. You know, I would say Sorcerer has a whole bunch of very impressive moments. You've noted the sequence where they're working on the trucks, or the explosions, or some of the shots that Friedkin's able to capture. It's just all absolutely phenomenal. But the sum of its parts, unfortunately, do not add up to anywhere near the film that The Wages of Fear is.
No, and one funny note is, but before we began recording here today, I did go back and I watched the trailers for each one, just to, you know, put myself back into the filmmaking mode of what these directors were doing and how they composed their shots. And I will say that Sorcerer's trailer is one of the best trailers I've ever seen, because it's just showing you these awesome shots really quickly without, you know, spending that 30 minutes building up the backstory. So you just get all the best parts of those things, and it's pretty dang sleek. So there's a plug for the trailer, if not for the film.
Well, in this episode, people will have heard aspects from both trailers. So good to know. But yes, check out the trailers if you want to just see the highlights, I guess.
Well, it never hurts to do a little taste test and figure it out. I think it's worth noting that we watched The Wages of Fear before we watched Sorcerer. And in retrospect, I don't know about you, Dakota, but I would actually recommend probably watching Sorcerer first, because I think we both are pretty unanimous here in being let down by Sorcerer. And so if you watch it first, yes, it may be more impressive than watching The Wages of Fear, which is one of the best films I've seen from the 1950s ever, before watching Sorcerer. Like, you know, it's just, it's easier to watch and appreciate a good film if you aren't comparing it to a great film that you've already watched.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. For this, you know, series that I do, I always prefer watching the original first and then the remake second, only because it is interesting to see where the director of the remake is pulling inspiration. Like, there's a couple shots that are very clearly direct copies. And I don't mean this in any sort of pejorative way. Like in Sorcerer, there's a shot of the low-flying airplane where Nilo gets off the plane in his white suit.
Yes.
As an exact shot-for-shot recreation from The Wages of Fear. And something that, like, is very nice to see. And you understand that he's building on what Clouseau had originally done in his own way. And so that's why I will always watch the original first and the remake second. But out of pure enjoyment, I think if I was to do it again and not doing it for a podcast or any sort of creative purpose, I would watch Sorcerer on its own and then later watch The Wages of Fear, because it is just such a letdown as you're watching and being like, where is the tension that The Wages of Fear had?
Yes, you put it perfectly. That's my thoughts exactly. I really, really enjoy The Wages of Fear more, but what Friedkin accomplished as a filmmaker, extra textual to the film itself in Sorcerer, is, you know, worth a 10-hour conversation all on its own. So I look forward to traveling up to Vancouver and buying you a beer and talking about this a little bit further.
Excellent. Taylor, I want to thank you so much for joining the show today. It was a real pleasure, and I had a great conversation about these two films.
Thanks for the invitation. Hope to do it again.
Where can people find your work, and do you have anything in particular you would like to promote?
People can find our work on drinkinthemovies.com. From there, you'll be able to find all our written reviews, interviews, podcast episodes, all that jazz. As far as new exciting things that we're doing, I'm going to say that sometime in January, Drinking the Movies will be putting out all sorts of superlative lists of the best of 2023, our top 10 films of 2023, as well as our favorite films that were not 2023 releases that we did watch in 2023. And that list, I think, in particular, is going to have one of the films we watched today on it being The Wages of Fear for me.
Excellent. I cannot wait to hear what you and Michael are getting up to.
Awesome.
Over on ContraZoomPod.com, we have new reviews for Napoleon by our newest writer, Jay Stryker, and Total Trust, a documentary about surveillance in China written by Brody Cottenham. As mentioned earlier, we just launched a new critics group, the CFTCA, where this past week we've slowly been naming our nominees for the inaugural Best Cascadian Film. And later this week, we will be announcing our top 10 films of the year as voted on by every member of the group. And I'll give a small teaser that you wrote about the new Christian Petzold film, A Fire, and I wrote about Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest, but I will not say where the films landed on the list yet, which is going to be a surprise to you because you don't know what the final list
is. I didn't even know you wrote about The Zone of Interest or that it finaled. So that's a good nugget there. And I'm certain that A Fire is where it belongs, which is number one on the list because it is the best film of 2023. Something we can all agree on, right?
I cannot say. But yeah, so just some more nuggets for that. We'll be talking about more. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, on the next episode, we're going to have Matthew and Simon on, and I guarantee there will be more CFTCA chat. I haven't had to say that out loud very many times, so it is a bit of a mouthful at times when I'm trying to rush through it.
Yeah, CFTCA, right? Did I nail it?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, that's my one take.
This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. How do you think The Wages of Fear and Sorcerer stack up next to each other? Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smale for the theme music and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on coffee. Thanks for checking us out.